be seated.
Case number CA-13182, University of Omaha, Nebraska, versus University of Hawaii at Hall. David Kuzma Franco for appellate. Lisa Munger for appellate, University of Hawaii and Thomas M. Apple. And Julie Sheehan for appellate, Department of Land and Natural Resources, Florida Land and Natural Resources, and William Hyde.
Morning. Ready to proceed, counsel?
Aloha. This case is about the university's failure to provide full and honest disclosure to the public. UH, driven by its desire to build a 14-story tall building at the summit of Haleakala, circumvented HRS Chapter 343. UH failed to prepare an EIS that disclosed the significant impacts of proposed development at the summit of Haleakala, which is an important cultural resource, a site of stunning natural beauty, and a popular visitor destination. Today, I'd like to discuss three things. First, the importance of a management plan. Second, the need to prepare an EIS for the management plan. And finally, the consequences of not complying with HRS Chapter 343. First, the management plan. By definition, by rule, a management plan is, quote, a comprehensive plan for carrying out multiple land uses. It is a necessary step to allowing more observatories to be built. It is not merely, as defendants would characterize it, an itemization of mitigation measures. Rather, under this management plan, quote, new facilities would be developed. That's what the executive summary of the management plan says.
Does the management plan in and of itself authorize the new facility?
In and of itself, it does not. It is a precursor step, similar, for example, to when Castle and Cook needed a boundary amendment for its Coal Ridge project. It sought a boundary amendment for the Land Use Commission. That was one step in a series of steps it needed to build. Now, this management plan is, quote, the governing document used for existing and future development. That comes directly from the management plan. It is implemented to, quote, regulate land use. Because this management plan is a comprehensive plan, it necessarily includes component parts. It is the sum of its component parts. The management plan is an umbrella document that includes component parts such as the ATST project. Now, the ATST project is a component of the management plan. It is a secondary impact of the management plan. And it is a reasonably foreseeable action, and therefore part of the cumulative impact of the management plan.
Are there other projects included in the management plan besides the ATST project?
Yes, Your Honor. There are, well, first of all, the management plan discusses future developments. It talks about the ATST project. It also refers to the Pan-STARRS project. The environmental assessment refers to something called the SLR 2000 as a potential future project. So,
am I right that the Pan-STARRS has been taken off the table?
As far as we know, yes, Your Honor. Now, given the ATST's relationship with the management plan, Chapter 343 required an EIS be prepared. In the year 2000, the state legislature amended Chapter 343. It did so to ensure full disclosure of cultural impacts. The Supreme Court in the Kapa'akai case, in a footnote, talked about the legislative purpose. Quoting the committee report, it said, the failure to require environmental impact statements to disclose the effect of a proposed action on cultural practices has resulted in the loss of cultural resources. Your committee believes that this measure will result in a more thorough consideration of an action's potential adverse impact on Hawaiian culture and tradition, ensuring the culture's protection and preservation.
But if the individual projects themselves are required to have an EIS, what is lost by not requiring an EIS for a management plan?
Three things, Your Honor. First of all, if you read the last, essentially the last page of substantively of the EA, it says the management plan will not have a significant impact. It's a determination. This determination is not truthful. Is contradicted by portions of the EIS for the ATST project. So this conclusion in and of itself must be rewritten. It's not true. So it is legally, in fact, incorrect for it to come to that conclusion. But secondly, an EIS for the management plan must comprehensively assess impacts and address them. So, for example, it must consider what things look like at full buildup. It's interesting to note that one of the provisions of the management plan is that new observatories can't block the views from existing observatories. But there's not one word about blocking views for the public. What is too much construction there? What is the capacity of the summit? That kind of analysis is supposed to occur in an EIS, looking at the cumulative impacts and what are the impacts on visual resources, cultural resources, etc.
So you don't think that that analysis could be made incrementally on a project-by-project basis?
Not in this, well, as far as the management plan is concerned, it cannot be, for a couple reasons. Number one, it is a comprehensive plan by definition. And therefore, to look at things incrementally is not appropriate. And the law does not favor that. The Supreme Court has said over and over again, if you look at the Hana Sunset, the Super Ferry, such segmented analysis is not appropriate. The management plan is the first step of many steps. And therefore, it needs to look at all these impacts in a comprehensive manner.
Is your position is that all management plans require an EIS, or some management plans require an EIS and others don't?
No, Your Honor. Various departments in state government may have management plans. We're talking about this specific management plan, its specific contents, and we're looking at also considering the rules that DLNR has. Okay. Now, let me address,
before you address that, do we have a case on point with particular facts that a management plan required an EIS?
No, you don't. There is a case, Mauna Kea case, which is distinguishable in three very significant ways. First, in that case, you wrote, quote, well, the management plan, quote, was presented as a standalone document unrelated to any specific proposed land use permit applications. Here, it clearly is tied in. We have a letter, two letters, from the Department of Land and Natural Resources to the university saying, when you submit your proposal for the ATST project, it must come with a management plan. You have the staff submitting both the same, the staff of DLNR submitting both items, the management plan and the ATST's conservation district use application at the same meeting. You have the Board of Land and Natural Resources having public testimony on both items at the same time. These two items were tied in. So it's factually quite different from what happened in the Mauna Kea situation. Secondly, this court concluded that in the Mauna Kea case, no land uses were proposed. In this case, however, the management plan includes a section titled Proposed Land Uses on Parcel. That's dramatically different than the Mauna Kea case. The executive summary says, under this management plan, new facilities would be developed. The EA talks about the use of excavators, bulldozers, backhoes, graders, compactors, and cranes. Clearly, there are uses being proposed here.
Counsel, I think I agree with you on the related to question, but I have a harder time on the proposal issue. Even though the document itself talks about proposed land uses, because is anything approved by the board action that amounts to in response to a proposal?
Okay, I think we need to take a big step backwards and think, how does 343 work? First, there has to be, there can be a discretionary approval if 343-5B is involved, and a project that uses state land or that uses conservation district land. In this case, we have that. In Sierra Club versus Office of Planning, Castle and Cook did not propose for their big project the use of state land. They were looking for reclassification, but their project also involved tunneling under a state highway later on for their water and wastewater. That was a minor component of the whole project and just briefly mentioned in one of the reports. Nevertheless, because the project involved the use of state land, because there was a proposal to use it, Chapter 343 was triggered. In Ohanapala, your case, you said the use of state land plainly and ambiguously requires preparation of an EA. Here, under this new management plan says, quote, new facilities would be developed. There's that section that says proposed land uses on parcel. That's a proposed use. The management plan repeatedly discusses the ATST project. It doesn't matter that this project will need a subsequent, that future, let's say, construction projects need a subsequent approval. In Sierra Club versus Office of Planning, that was the case. In Kahana Sunset, the Supreme Court looked at the fact that the drainage system needed a separate approval from the Department of Public Works. And Citizens for Protection of North Kohala Coastline. Similarly, another approval would have been needed for the underpass they were proposing. It doesn't matter that the project for it to be built needs a subsequent approval. And the Supreme Court, well, the Supreme Court in the recent Lake case, emphasized that it is not critical if a project needs a subsequent approval from another agency or even from the same agency. It's just not relevant.
Wasn't that just a case on rightness, though?
That's true. That's true. But I think if you look at the line of cases, Mahuiki, Blake, Sierra Club versus Office Planning, it is not relevant whether another approval is necessary. And what the court has emphasized is 343 is triggered at the earliest practical time. Now I want to go further on what you've brought up. We know that Chapter 343 applies in this case for five reasons. First of all, the Super Ferry Court said that exceptions to Chapter 343 must be narrowly construed. That's footnote 22. Secondly, the University of Hawaii has already admitted that Chapter 343 applies. They prepared an environmental assessment, in their words, in accordance with Hawaii Revised Statute Chapter 343. That comes right out of their environmental assessment. Their management plan says a draft EA has been prepared in accordance with State of Hawaii HRS Chapter 343 to ensure compliance with the policies and goals defined in that statute. Now, in the Roxas versus Marcos case, the Supreme Court held that a party cannot blow hot and cold. And in Waihole, the Supreme Court said a reviewing court must judge the propriety of agency action solely by the grounds invoked by the agency. Here, the agency has said it's not exempt, that 343 applies. They're bound by that. So for them to argue that 343 doesn't apply is really inappropriate. That was their belief, that was the position they took before litigation commenced, and it's not appropriate for them to change that position.
So you're saying we should apply the judicial estoppel to their HRS Chapter 343 applicability position?
I think there are three doctrines, and I don't know the correct word. Judicial estoppel is one principle. Waiver is another principle, or overlapping principle, or the principle that an agency cannot articulate a new reason than the one it articulated originally. Yes, Your Honor. So in this case, the University of Hawaii prepared their environmental assessment and concluded that the primary, secondary, and cumulative impacts were insignificant. But this conclusion is contradicted by information in their own environmental assessment. They say there was overwhelming evidence from a cultural and traditional standpoint that construction of a large visible structure would result in a significant impact on some Native Hawaiian traditional cultural practices and beliefs. Now, the standard in 343 is if a project may have a significant impact, an EIS must be prepared. And the Unite Here Court, the Supreme Court's decision Unite Here, says if any substantial questions are raised, then an EIS is necessary. Here, right there, there are substantial questions raised. Moreover, in their ATST EIS, UH admitted their project will have significant impacts. They concluded that the ATST project would, quote, result in major, adverse, short, and long-term direct impacts on the traditional cultural resources. That's their statement. The ATST is both a component of the management plan as identified as a proposed land use. It is a secondary impact because we know that it is only after management plan is approved that the ATST can be approved. And thirdly, it's clearly a reasonable, foreseeable project that's discussed by them. Given the significant impact of the ATST project, the management plan had to admit that overall the cumulative impact was significant and had to consider the impact of this project as well as other projects that it is foreseeing being built. Given that an EIS was necessary, the BLNR's approval of the management plan must be vacated because compliance with Chapter 343 is mandatory before any approval is granted.
Are you arguing that we can decide this case as a matter of law, whether or not the EIS was necessary based on the current record without any of the material you requested through discovery?
We believe that you can, yes, sir, we believe that the record is sufficient for you to conclude the circuit court was incorrect to grant summary judgment to the university and should have actually, summary judgment should be granted to plaintiff. We believe that the circuit court misapplied the rules of discovery and it was an abuse of discretion. However, we believe the record is sufficient for this court to conclude that an EIS was necessary.
Is it sufficient to conclude the EIS was not necessary?
No, Your Honor. I don't know what principle that would lead this court to that conclusion. However, we specifically requested documents that any documents relating to UH's determination that the management plan would have no significant impact, and any documents relating to UH's creation and or preparation of the management plan. We don't know what these documents are. We don't know what they have. Clearly, they must have something beyond what.
So they go to the issue of impact.
Correct. And so there may be very revealing, damaging documents there that, depending on, I don't know what the analysis would be that would lead you to that conclusion, but clearly there could be documents that undercut that.
Now, we've had two other appeals, you know, coming from this whole project. One that came up here,
yes.
We dismissed, or we affirmed the lower court dismissing it on mootness, a contested case. We were successful in the Supreme Court. That case was, our decision was vacated, was remanded to the circuit court, currently pending. And we have another appeal currently coming up that I don't think has been briefed, also an agency appeal. Do those two cases in any way impact this current appeal you're arguing before us?
The word impact is a loaded word. There's definitely a relationship between the cases. The December 2010 Conservation District use permit has been voided. So now the only issues are the November 2012 permit. If this court agrees with us that an EIS is necessary and it concludes that the management plan could not have been approved and then takes the next step and says, therefore, the Conservation District use permit that was granted in November 2012 also could not be authorized, this court could potentially moot out the other appeal. Not necessarily, I mean, obviously it depends on how you rule, et cetera, but there is a potential impact there, yes. And which gets to, I believe, where I was, that there are four decisions by the Hawaii Supreme Court in which EISs were not prepared. And in each case, without any sort of balancing of interests whatsoever, the underlying permits were vacated. Kahana Sunset, the SMA permit was vacated. In Kipo'o, a lease was voided. In Pearl Ridge, the reclassification by the Land Use Commission was reversed. And in Sierra Club versus Office of Planning, the reclassification was also reversed. That's mandated by the plain language in 343-5C, which says acceptance of a required final statement shall be a condition precedent to approval of the request and commencement of the proposed action. So the plain language of H versus 343 requires no approval can be granted until full compliance with the law. Expediency drove UH to declare that its management plan would not have a significant impact. An EIS should have been prepared because there's no question that the primary, secondary, and cumulative impacts are significant. The impacts to cultural resources, scenic vistas, and quite are devastating. This court should condemn UH's failure to provide full and honest disclosure to the public. It should, one, rule that an EIS rather than an EA is required for the management plan. Second, it should reverse the approval of the management plan because the management plan can only be approved after EIS is complete. And third, it should reverse the Conservation District use permit for the ATST project because astronomy projects cannot be approved until the management plan is approved, which can only happen after compliance with Chapter 343.
Okay, the CDU permit's not before us, though, right now, is it?
Well, if you look at our
I understand
relief,
your argument on the impact, but
well,
aren't we just looking at the summary judgment on count one, which is an EIS for the management plan? Isn't that pretty much it?
I disagree, Your Honor. If you look at the requested relief we asked for, and also if you, we are also appealing the circuit court's denial of our summary judgment motion. In our summary judgment motion, we asked for Conservation District use permit to be voided. So I do believe that is appropriately before you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Munger?
Good morning. May it please the court, Lisa Munger, appearing on behalf of the University of Hawaii, as well as Thomas Apple, its chancellor. With me today are Lisa Bale, Adam Robinson, and Christine Tirada. I appreciate their assistance as well. As the briefing in this case and as indicates, the complete purpose of Chapter 343 is informed decision making. All that is required is that the environmental documents afford the decision maker with the information that it needs to make its decision. And that's why over and over and over again in the Price decision, the course emphasizes the purpose of the statute. That's why there's a rule of reason, that a document will be upheld as adequate if it's been compiled in good faith and if sufficient information is there. That's why the Price court says you're not to flyspeck these environmental documents. And it quotes well-settled NEPA law for the propositions that 343 isn't to be used as a crutch for fault-finding, nor as a means of delaying proper projects. And with that in mind, I stand before you apparently on a different record than the record presented by the appellants, because the record in this case contains two environmental review documents. There is the two volumes which is the environmental assessment for the management plan. And there is the four-volume stack, which is the final environmental impact statement for the ATST, the Advanced Technology Solar Telescope, a remarkable project to study the sun. And in effect, and that EIS for the ATST, which provided full disclosure of its impacts, was approved in 2009. And there's been no challenge to it whatsoever. So what appellant is asking this court to find is that our two-volume EA about the management plan should actually be six volumes, or maybe 10 or 14 if other projects were concluded. But that's what it needs to have informed decision-making. That is not the case. This environmental assessment is for the management plan, which contains, by its very words, measures to protect the environment and resources at the summit, and to guide the university as a steward of the 18 acres at the Haleakala High Altitude Observatories. The management plan, as set forth in it, arises out of the long-range development plan that the university has, where it has looked forward and thought about what may come in the future. The management plan originally was part of that document, But with the BLNR rules, a separate management plan was prepared, which summarizes those conservation measures. And if you look to the exact language of the justification for the identified land use at page 39 of the management plan itself, which is attached as Appendix A to our brief, and I apologize, I don't have the Jeff's number, but I can provide that to the board. The proposed land use is to continue using HL for astronomical research facilities for advanced studies in astronomy and atmospheric sciences. The expected timing is it's intended to be, to serve as a planning process for the next 10 years. The monitoring strategies govern existing and future development. But all that this management plan approves is that the measures identified in it will be used by the university going forward. It is the essence of a planning document. So the environmental assessment, knowing that what was at issue, what was being approved with this management plan, was this process of stewardship, these management measures, did as all environmental assessments did. It said, this is the action, and we're going to compare that to the no action alternative.
Is it your position that management plans, an EIS is never required for a management plan? Would that be your position? Or does it depend on the management plan?
It depends on the management plan in that this is a management plan that calls for overriding principles. It does not approve any particular project. I can envision that perhaps someone someday could write a management plan that's more in the nature of the programmatic EIS documents that you see under NEPA, where you have, you say our program is to develop 1,000 acres.
So it's your position that you have to look at the particular management plan to determine whether or not an EIS is required.
I think so, because I think as management plan is defined in the DLNR rules, I don't think an EIS is required. So in this context, I can't envision a management plan for which an EIS would be required. I can envision that someone might call something a management plan, which is really an approval of development or an approval, what comes to mind are the programmatic EISs. So this is not that. This type of management plan is not that. But I don't think that a management plan contemplates having an environmental, if what you're doing is what's being done here.
What about the fact that in this case, there's BLNR statements or correspondence in the record that indicates that UH was supposed to submit the management plan together with the CDUA. So it accompanies a use application.
They were separate matters, but yes, they were at the same time, and the BLNR rules do that. But what accompanied the management plan was its EA. What accompanied the management plan was its environmental assessment. What accompanied the Conservation District use application was the 4-volume final EIS for the ATST. They were separate approvals with separate environmental disclosures. This is not the case, this bears no resemblance to the segmentation cases where people chop up a project into little bits in order to evade environmental review. This environmental review is targeted to the action at issue, so that the environmental assessment for the management plan looks to what are the impacts of the management plan. The final EIS for the ATST looks to what are the impacts of the ATST. And so when you look at the environmental assessment and it compares the impacts of the management plan, is it a good idea to protect archaeological resources? Is it a good idea to protect the endangered petrel? Should we continue to protect against invasive species? Not surprisingly, the environmental assessment concluded that implementing those measures was better than the no action alternative of doing nothing. And that's the purpose of informed decision, deciding whether the decision you are about to make, what are the environmental impacts of that? The management plan, final EA, states that the plan is the action is the management plan, and it specifically states that it's not intended to assess impacts from construction or other operations which are authorized quite separately. With that, what plaintiff's argument tries to do is to somehow make DAT and the management plan one. And it has three different theories, inconsistent theories for doing so, and I'd like to address each of those briefly in turn. The first is, as I mentioned, that they argue that the ATSG is part and parcel of the management plan. It is not, by its own words. And the cases that they rely on, the segmentation cases, have no application here except to prove this isn't that. What the segmentation cases do is define the requirement under 11200-7 and give guidance on what is meant to be part of, or a necessary precedent for, or a commitment to a larger project. That's the test. And as those terms are defined in the segmentation cases, particularly Kahana Sunset comes to mind, you're part of, or a necessary precedent of, you look to whether the undertaking has independent utility, or whether it would not have been created except as a part of a larger development. And on that, the management plan itself provides the answer. The management plan has independent utility. It's going to apply to the existing facilities, anything that comes in the future. It's a 10-year planning document. It arose out of the long-range development process. It completely has independent utility. And more to the point, it certainly would not have been created except as part of the larger development. It was part of the management. The management plan comes out of the long-range development plan. It's not ATSD specific. It's stewardship for the 18 acres that the university has for astronomy on Haleakala. So plainly, these are separate. And as they are separate, having separate, thorough environmental review documents is appropriate. No evasion of environmental review. The second argument, and it went quite quickly, was that the ATSD is a secondary effect of the management plan. The ATSD is not a secondary effect of the management plan. The rules define secondary effect in terms of causation. Secondary effect means something that's caused by the action, but is later in time or removed in distance. And the ATSD surely was not caused by the management plan.
There's certainly linkage, though.
Well, there is a linkage in that one of the that you need to have a management plan to have astronomy at the summit. Certainly, that's the case. But having that does not cause the ATSD. And I think you can really readily distinguish the Molokai Homesteaders and Super Ferry cases in that respect. In the Molokai Homesteaders case, the whole point of applying for space, direct space in the Molokai irrigation system, was to develop the resort. So having that water was for no other purpose than to have that resort. Similarly, in the Super Ferry case, the court talked about the physical improvements at the harbor that were there to be used by Super Ferry. They were not, this was not a harbor master plan where any ship might berth. These were specific to, so when you do the specific harbor improvements, you need to look at what it will enable, and what it would enable was the Super Ferry. This is not a secondary effects case. So the question is, well, shouldn't you have considered it in the cumulative impacts analysis? And the answer is yes, and the answer is we did include it in the cumulative impacts analysis. The finding of no significance determination, or negative declaration as it used to be called, under the statute, is that the subject action will not have a significant effect. The irretrievable commitment of resources. If you look at the definition of cumulative effects, it's the impact of the action when considered in connection with past, present, and reasonably foreseeable actions. It does not mean, and it does not say, that your foreseeable actions become part of the action itself. Quite to the contrary, it uses the word, what is the incremental impact of the action when considered among these other impacts. That is the test. And when you do that here, the conclusion was that having a management plan which has construction guidelines, which has design guidelines, would be better than not having it. So it was plain that the cumulative impacts analysis was done. The ATST was part of it. And again, going back to the theme that is the heart of Chapter 343, informed decision making, all of that was known to the board.
Counsel, is there a provision in the BLNR rules that recognizes or addresses the possibility of amendment to management plans?
Yes, and so exactly. And I think that it's contemplated that they are living documents. The management plans themselves have a requirement that you annually give updates or report on what you're doing, and it contemplates that as you do those reports, that if something comes up, you better address it, and if a new measure needs to be made, that you amend them. Those happen, that is exactly what's contemplated. It's contemplated to be a living document with oversight from the board. So, to take that argument a step further, it would suggest that, well, first, it certainly supports the independent utility. It does have a life of its own. It certainly also is continuing to benefit the environment. And it doesn't mean when it's later superseded that everything that was approved under an older one is suddenly invalid. No such rule to that effect. I'd like to address a couple of the points made by counsel with respect to university admissions. Environmental review documents are disclosures. They are not admissions. And what you do in a disclosure is disclose everything that people say. And so, for example, in the environmental assessment for this project, you will find, I did not include it in my Appendix A, but which was just the text of the environmental assessment. But if you look at the full two-volume environmental assessment, there's a section on the comments. So all of the comments that you've heard today from appellant concerning the ATST and what the final EIS says and how that needs to be considered, all of that is in this final EA, as well as the university's response to it. So the board had all the information. That's all that this law requires, is providing that.
And the EIS would not have provided further information?
And the EIS would not have provided further information. The management plan references the 2009 final EIS, which had been prepared, to which there is no challenge. And there is no, I think that if you look to these EIS cases, to set one aside, you have to say that it was arbitrary and capricious based on known environmental consequences, something that was known that people somehow ignored. And that's not the case here. Everything was there. It was not ignored. It was part of the document. I think that all of that goes to show that it probably doesn't make sense to do environmental assessments for these management plans, and I think the DLNR has clarified its rules to state that. But I wanted to address just briefly the argument that this was an admission, that doing it was an admission on our part that it was required. And so why on earth did you do that? And I think that the long and short answer, as you can intuit from the documents itself, is that the DLNR's rules talked about having an environmental assessment and to accompany your management plan, and so we did. But we don't think that DLNR determination that you should do an environmental assessment is necessarily determinative of the law of Chapter 343, and I think both the Circuit Court and this Court are free to look to the language of the management plan itself.
Aren't we supposed to give some deference to an agency construing its own statutory regulatory scheme?
Well, I think you will hear from the Department of Land and Natural Resources that that was not in, that it's their view as well that that was not required. But again, I don't think that it's one that one should punish the university for making disclosures. I'd like to address briefly the issue of the consequences. And I'd like to address the consequences because appellant makes an argument that really is not supported at all by Chapter 343. First, let's sort of review the bidding on where we are. Counts 2 through 5 have been are no longer the subject of this appeal. By appellant's motion, counts 2 through 4 are gone. So no DLNR permit is before this court. The only thing that is before this court is the environmental assessment for the management plan. And Keipo'o versus Kane does not say what appellant thinks it says. If I get the language of Chapter 343, what it actually says is that the uh, 343D says that the acceptance of a required final statement shall be a condition precedent to implementation of the proposed action. That's the language I need. And then this is not, there is no null and void language as stated in their brief. I don't know quite where that comes from. But the as to the management plan, and I'll address that in a moment, I can see how perhaps this could be applied. But as to the ATST, this language has absolutely no application whatsoever. The Advanced Technology Solar Telescope had an accepted required final statement, and that was a condition precedent to the implementation of the proposed action. The ATST has 4 volumes. It doesn't need any other environmental review. And not only was that not challenged, but the same section, 343.5, it's now subsection I, it used to be subsection G, states that a statement that is accepted with respect to a particular action shall satisfy the requirements of this chapter, and no other statement shall be required. So as to the ATST, we're completely done. That has a final acceptance under 343. Nothing else can be required for it under Chapter 343. Now, as for the management plan, I would suggest to the court that there is no such thing as an automatic injunction. And for that, I would refer to the Super Ferry case, where at the end of the case, in finding that there was no, that the exemption determination was in error and that an environmental review should be done, the Supreme Court did not take the next step of dictating whether an injunction should issue or disapproving anything anybody had done. It simply announced that ruling determination and remanded to the circuit court for further proceedings. There was no order precluding the use of state lands. And I think Keipo'o is quite distinguishable from this case. There, they found that that was an EA done for a lease for a huge power plant. So the power plant should have been studied. And they found that a power plant, it surely deserves an EIS. That's certainly a far, far, far cry from a management plan. But in any way, in any event, I don't think that here there was no information that was not before the board on the management plan. There's nothing here adverse that needs to be stopped. The rule in Chapter 343 is a rule of general application. If conduct is found to be unlawful, there still needs to be a balancing of the equities before a court orders injunctive relief. I don't think the Chapter 340, anything in Chapter 3 requires this court to check its equitable powers at the door. And so the question is, does it make any sense at all to enjoin the management plan measures that are here? Does it make any sense to tell the university, stop, stop this invasive species measures, stop protecting archaeological resources, stop having construction measures for future projects? No. There's absolutely nothing in the management plan that appellant seeks to stop. And in such a circumstance, truthfully, to use this law to stop a management plan provides, where disclosures have been made, really just makes a mockery of Chapter 343.
Ms. Munger, if I can ask another question. I know you're running out of time. So you said that the management plan is a 10-year plan, right? If an EIS is not required, if your position prevails and EIS is not required for this management plan, is there any other way or process where there would be an assessment of the cumulative impact of a 10-year plan, a long-term plan, like what takes its place? Do we have other protection?
So and that happened actually in this EA. It looked at the projects that are reasonably foreseeable, and the only projects that were reasonably foreseeable were the ones that were disclosed. And so the plan contemplates that it will be updated in the future. At some point, as it's updated in the future, maybe something else will be planned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Chin.
May it please the court. Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Julie Chino, on behalf of the Board of Land and Natural Resources, Department of Land and Natural Resources, and William Isler, in his official capacity as Chairperson of the Board of Land and Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to address this court. I would first like to briefly touch upon Judge Rafe's question regarding amending management plans. Exhibit 3 to Chapter 13.5 provides that there shall be, management plan shall include reporting schedules and also set forth the duration of the management plan. Now, this management plan is effective December 1st, 2010 to November 30th, 2020. Second, I'd like to briefly address Judge Foley's question about what is before this court. Is the 2012 Advanced Technology Solar Telescope Conservation District Use Permit before this court? It is not. The Advanced Technology Solar Telescope Conservation District Use Permit approval is before the court in an administrative appeal. Referenced in our statement of related cases, it's CAP 13-0003065. The court does not have jurisdiction to entertain this action for declaratory relief because appellant has a specific remedy available to it under HRS Section 9114. And citing Haas and Haney Corp. v. Pacific Millwork Supply, that court stated it is well settled that courts will not entertain a declaratory judgment action if there is pending at the time of the commencement of the action for declaratory relief an action or proceeding to which the same persons are parties and in which the same issues may be adjudicated. Now, the same permit, if the court finds that it is before this court, would be before two separate courts, subject possibly to two separate decisions. Appellant cannot really circumvent the agency appeal with a declaratory action against the 2012 permit. I'd also like to respond to Judge Foley's question regarding management plans and whether they or not they should be looked at individually. They should. This management plan specifically states that it was prepared according to Exhibit 3 to Hawaii Administrative Rules 13.5. Now, the board's administrative rules at that do not require an environmental assessment for this particular management plan. When the management plan was approved by the board, Exhibit 3 to Chapter 13.5 required an environmental assessment for each proposed land use. Now, land use under under 183C2 entails placing or removing material from this or the subdivision of land. It requires some sort of action dealing with the land. For example, in the recent PILA 400B versus BLNR case, the dumping of mud and dirt on conservation land was a land use under Chapter 183C. This court previously reviewed, and Judge Foley wrote the decision in Mauna Kea Ana Ina Ho. And that in that case, the management plan was also drafted pursuant to Exhibit 3 of Chapter 13.5 of the Hawaii Administrative Rules. The Mauna Kea Comprehensive Management Plan itself stated that this management plan provides the framework for managing multiple existing and future activities, such as astronomy, recreational and commercial activities, scientific research, and cultural and religious activities. The court still, even in that case, with all of those management actions contemplated, determined that the management plan does not propose or approve new land uses. It's the same here. Moreover, as a result of the 2011 amendment to that administrative rule, if considered today by the board, a management plan would clearly not require an EA, let alone an EIS, under those rules.
Thank you, Ms. Chan.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If I have time, I'd like to respond to five things that were brought up. First, university claims that EA was prepared in good faith and did a good job disclosing impacts. Let's look at what EA said and did. When it talked about drainage, the EA specifically says the two known potential future projects, SLR 2000 and the proposed ATST project, would not have significant impacts on runoff or drainage patterns. We don't dispute that. On drainage, management plan said no significant impact, and it relied in part on the impacts from the ATST project. When it comes to visual impacts, here's what they said. The proposed ATST project is a project that would have adverse impacts on visual resources beyond those addressed in the management plan, and those have been analyzed elsewhere. Well, what are those impacts? Where's this full, honest disclosure? No, the university knows what those impacts are, but refuses to include even one sentence that says it. When it comes to cultural impacts, here's what they say. Separate environmental documentation will be completed for each new proposed action, and any impacts to cultural resources for each project will be analyzed individually. But wait a minute. When it came to drainage, you were up front and said the ATST won't have an impact. But when it comes to cultural issues or visual issues, no disclosure. That's not an EA compiled in good faith. They did not fully disclose the impact of projects they knew were triggered or were forthcoming from this management plan. The university claims, oh, the management plan just has protective measures. It just does good things. Well, the five problems with this argument, first of all, the U.S. National Park Service, when it does management plans, they do good things. They prepare EAs and EISs, and we've cited two cases for you in a brief that mention this. Secondly, their management plan provides solar observatories will be white, and yet they mention in their management plan, and in their environmental assessment, and in the ATST EIS, that it is the white color that is so objectionable visually and culturally, it stands out dramatically. If this is a management plan to protect scenic resources, if this is a management plan to protect cultural resources, that issue must be addressed head on. Instead, these are not simply protective measures, these are measures that facilitate development. In fact, that's what a management plan is. It's a comprehensive plan for carrying out multiple land uses. It's not simply an itemization of protective measures. This mitigation plan has no height limits, no size limits, no restrictions on the number of buildings. It prohibits obstructing views of other observatories, but doesn't prohibit obstructing views that the public looks at. It is disingenuous to describe this merely as a catalog of mitigation and protective measures. The management plan is a necessary step to getting other structures built. And that's why it was submitted. It was submitted at the same time the ATST project was proposed for the Board of Land and Natural Resources. Next issue. They argue Chapter 343 doesn't apply. Yes, it does. There's a use of state land here. The use is as obvious as it was to this court in Ohana Park. The EA talks about the use of excavators, bulldozers, backhoes, graders, compactors, and cranes. Those are uses of state land. Under this management plan, quote, new facilities would be developed. Those are their words. There's a section of the management plan titled Proposed Land Uses on Parcel. And the management plan repeatedly refers to the ATST project. It's a known potential future project. This management plan is a project that involves uses of state land and land in the conservation district. The analysis in Mauna Kea is not applicable here because the key issue there was whether a contested case hearing was required and whether essentially property rights were transferred, whether any property rights were involved. When it comes to HRS Chapter 343, property rights is not an analysis, part of the analysis whatsoever. All that it requires is someone is proposing a project that proposes the use of state land. This management plan proposes to use state land. Even if you want to ignore the ATST project, they talk about vector control and weeding. Those are all uses of state land, and they have not declared that these activities are exempt. It's unquestionable that they're proposing to use state land. Now, they have argued, although not so much today, a little bit, that, well, this is only a feasibility study. It's not really anything. Yet, this has substantive effect, unlike just a study. It is the governing document used for existing and future development. It's implemented to regulate land use. Astronomy facilities cannot be built unless there's an approved management plan. HCR 1352 provides that the management plan is a comprehensive plan for carrying out multiple land uses. That's the legal definition. It is regulatory in the same way a county general plan is regulatory. And 343-5A6 identifies amendments to existing county general plans as a trigger for 343. Simply because it's a plan, it has the word plan in it, does not mean that it has no substantive effect. This has a regulatory effect, just like any general plan amendment. They argue that, well, the secondary impact analysis doesn't apply. As long as a project is done to facilitate something else, such as the super ferry, the wharf improvements were made to facilitate the super ferry. The Molokai case, the pipeline was built to facilitate development. It didn't cause development. The wharf improvements didn't cause the super ferry to exist, but they facilitated it. Just as a management plan here facilitates the development of the ATST project, is clearly a secondary impact. Finally, the word in the Kipo'o case talks about the lease at issue there being void at inception. Those words are in the case. The Supreme Council's resuscitation of the super ferry case is shocking. Justices asked Isaac Hall, counsel for the plaintiff's challenge to superferring, what kind of relief he was asking for. He did not ask for injunctive relief. He asked that the court send it back down to the circuit court. So for them to say, well, superferring court didn't order injunctive relief, that's because Isaac Hall, the counsel in the case, didn't ask for it. But in each of the other cases where 343 has been violated, the court has reversed and rendered void the permits at issue. The case the counsel for the state read talked about when two cases are filed and one is filed before the commencement of the action. I think the time frame is very important. This is the first of all the cumulative cases filed. And we specifically requested that all approvals be vacated pursuant to a flawed 343 process. So, given the statements that the university has made, the management plan is a use of state land and has significant impacts. An EIS should have been done, and all approvals need to be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. It's always enlightening to hear from the three of you. So, as usual, we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much.